From Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. During the weeks ahead, enjoy musical performances by the Munich Symphony Orchestra and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with violinist Sarah Chang. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
We'd like to say thanks to the 1,225 friends who helped WILL raise over $125,000 during last week's pledge drive. And welcome to the 204 new friends who came on board during the drive. Your support helps us sustain the programs and services you've come to expect and enjoy. Thank you. From the planets, Gustav Holst. That was the opening from Jupiter, the bringer of jollity. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, a journey through our solar system. Our guide is award-winning science journalist and author, Dava Sobel. She's the author of the bestsellers Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. Her latest book tells the stories of the planets of our solar system. The title of the book is The Planets. The book could be described as a collection of personal essays on the sun, our moon, and the planets. At the outset of the book, Dava Sobel says, "My planet fetish began, as best I can recall, in the third grade at age 8, right around the time I learned that Earth had siblings in space, just as I had older brothers in high school and college." Dava Sobel is a former science reporter for The New York Times. Her work has also appeared in Audubon, Discover, Life, and The New Yorker. Her awards include the National Science Board's Individual Public Service Award. If you have questions about our planets and new discoveries in astronomy, we'd like to hear from you this afternoon. Give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dava Sobel's latest book, The Planets, is published by Viking. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Dava, good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me back.
Oh, my pleasure. What led you to take this personal approach to the planets?
I really have a personal feeling for them, a real enthusiasm. Some kids love bugs, and some kids love dinosaurs, and then there are those of us who love planets, and I still do. And the subject matter doesn't have a continuous narrative story, so that forced me to find a different way. No story and no single hero to carry it. So I came up with this approach of treating the planets as individuals and tying each individual to a theme that is familiar, mythology or astrology or science fiction.
And it seems to me very appropriate, and maybe it was just serendipity, but you know, the word planet comes from the Greek word meaning wanderers.
Right.
And here really you're leading us through a wonderful wander.
Oh, how nice. Thank you. I hadn't made that connection. The word planet is causing astronomers some problems today because, as you point out, it's not a specific definition. And people are questioning whether Pluto should really be considered a planet, whether some of the new discoveries at the far edge of the solar system are also planets. So there's great debate in those circles about what should go into a more specific definition.
Yeah. What's the problem with Pluto?
It is one of thousands of small bodies that define the outer ring of the solar system. When it was discovered in 1930, people thought it was much larger than it has turned out to be. And now that hundreds of other Pluto-like worlds have been discovered in the past 10 years, people are saying, we got this wrong. A very similar thing happened in the early 1800s when the first asteroid was discovered, and that was thought to be a new planet. But then more of them turned up, and so they were demoted, if you will, and given this other designation, asteroids or minor planets. And I think there are good arguments for doing the same with Pluto.
Mm. The debate, from what I've read about it, seems fairly contentious. Why do you suppose that's the case, if that is the case?
There's a lot of emotion about Pluto. Even people who are not in the planetary science community feel a kinship with this world. I think partly because it's the only American-discovered planet, partly because it is small and it's being threatened with exclusion, so people who support the underdog, and of course Pluto is now a cartoon dog also and has some positive associations that way too, I think. And Walt Disney did name the cartoon character for the planet. So there's regret expressed at the thought that all those wonderful sentences we learned to remember all the planets would now come to an abrupt end without that final P. It seems sad to those of us of a certain age.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, I read an article about this in the New York Times not too long ago, from earlier this month, earlier in October. And I felt that same way that what you just described until I read this, a quote from Dr. Alan Boss of the Carnegie Institution. And he said he favors and hopes that the adjective planet compromise, which maybe you can talk about in a moment, will catch on in astronomy. And he said he thought the public would be thrilled to realize that astronomy had progressed so far as to require a resorting of the primary components of the solar system. He said, quote, science marches on. And this brouhaha is a sterling reminder of both the joy and the pain of this process.
Indeed. And I think people who follow this news will agree with him. But I think there are many more people who don't follow it and don't have any sense of major planet, minor planet, or even one planet from another. And those are the people I was hoping to write for.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Through the book, I had a good time, and I haven't read every single word of it yet, but I'm having a wonderful time exploring, dipping in, and enjoying the book so much. And there's so much here that I wish I had known, because it's so much fun to discover it. But I didn't. So it's just been a joy to realize, for example, that the sun is, you know, we're all in motion. Everything is in motion. But the sun itself is spinning very complexly, something I had no idea of. Were there things that took...
It's rotating, and it's also orbiting the center of the galaxy and carrying all the planets along with it, which is an amazing thing to think about.
Right.
We were in many kinds of motion.
Were there things that took you by surprise as you as you thought about the planets, our solar system?
Yes, and where I thought you were going, talking about the sun, is the sheer bulk of it and the fact that it accounts for not just the majority of the mass of the solar system, but 99.9%. That's how tremendous it really is. That all the other planets, moons, rings, are just that tiny fraction of a percentage point.
Mm. And the sun is spinning in layers of various speeds.
Right. Right. Well, it's all gas, so it's very complex. It's dense at its core, and then less dense further out. And its spinning causes a lot of magnetic disturbance. And the sun is constantly sending us streams of charged particles. If we didn't have a magnetic field around the Earth, we would not survive the onslaught of that material. And every now and then a really big burst does affect us, and we have a power grid knocked out, big blackouts. So we're interacting with the other bodies all the time. We're just not always aware of it.
Hmm. Do the other planets affect us?
Well, they do send us things from time to time. Meteorites from the Moon and Mars have actually been recovered on Earth without the difficulty of sending an astronaut there to pick them up and bring them home. And meteorites from the asteroids also fall to Earth. So that's very interesting to realize that we're being visited by these inanimate objects. And then Jupiter really offers us a fair amount of protection from comets coming in. It's thought that probably more comets would have struck the Earth if it weren't for Jupiter absorbing them or fending them off before they can reach us.
Yeah, which makes me go back to Pluto and it being named a planet relatively recently in 1930. But the search for Pluto began early in the 20th century. The search put into motion thanks to a problem posed by Neptune and Uranus.
Right. Those two planets were the first ones to be discovered by telescope. All the others you can see with the naked eye. Venus looks so bright and beautiful, and Saturn and Jupiter, when they're in the sky, you notice them if you're looking, because they're brighter than the background stars, and they are changing their places all the time. But Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto were all discoveries that had to wait until after the development of the telescope. And no one was expecting to find more planets, really, so the first one was a surprise. And it orbits very slowly. It takes Uranus more than 80 years to go around the sun. So it took a long time to understand the mechanics of its orbit. And there were a lot of problems with it, which made people think there was probably yet another planet further out affecting it. And that initiated the search for Neptune. And two men working independently, one in England, one in France, actually figured out that there was another giant planet and where it was just by attaching their brains to pencil and paper without any kind of observation of the sky. And it was only after they made their predictions that some other astronomers were finally convinced to look for this body and saw it where it was supposed to be. So the discussions of how the planets affected each other's orbits continued, and it was thought that there needed to be one more planet to account for everything. And this started a search that went on for decades and finally ended up with the discovery of Pluto. But in recent years, it's been shown that the big planets really do all account for each other. Pluto is much too small to have an effect on Uranus and Neptune, and so that adds to the argument about whether it should be considered a planet.
Hmm. Well, now we have a suggestion that there's a tenth planet, or maybe it would be the ninth planet if we take Pluto out of the running.
This is Xena.
Yes, Xena, that's the nickname.
That's its nickname. It's officially called 2003 UB313, because it was actually discovered in 2003, and that those letters and numbers are just a way discoverers can describe a new entity until it gets an official name. So that's a mouthful, and understandably they've come up with Xena as a shorthand name, and now Xena appears to have a moon, or mm-hmm. actually has a moon in orbit around it. So the moon has been nicknamed Gabrielle, who was the sidekick of Xena the warrior princess.
Right.
And this is all a lot of fun, but it points back to this big debate about how are we going to define planets in our solar system. These objects definitely belong to the solar system. They're much farther away from us than Pluto, but Xena is quite a bit larger than Pluto, probably half again as big.
Mm.
So it's an important entity to be dealt with.
Mm. And back to the debate over what is a planet, what do you think of this? What are the various camps, and what is this adjective planet idea?
Well, again, originally it just meant wanderer, so that in the earliest times, the sun and moon were considered planets because they also wander about the sky. But after Pluto was discovered, the observations of it began to show fairly soon that it wasn't as big as it had been thought to be. So as it got smaller, in the 1950s, an astronomer named Gerard Kuiper came up with the idea that probably there was a lot of stuff out at the edge of the solar system, that the solar system didn't come to a neat end at Neptune or Pluto, that there were probably hundreds or thousands of small bodies out there, and that when our telescopes got good enough, these would start to show up. And sure enough, in 1992, the first of these was discovered. And it soon became apparent that Pluto probably belonged to this group of outliers, so that it wasn't one of the giant gas planets, and it wasn't really like the terrestrial planets, Earth, Mars, Venus, and Mercury. But it was something other, some combination of rock and ice. And so when hundreds of them turned up, this group of objects was named the Kuiper Belt in honor of Gerard Kuiper, who had imagined it before it had been discovered. And so what is Pluto now? Is it the last planet, or is it the first member of this belt of objects out beyond Neptune?
Hmm.
So in that sense, I completely agree with Dr. Boss that this is all about knowing more, learning more. When you don't know anything about trees, you can just call them all trees. But if you look at them and start discovering the differences, then you have to make categories. And none of this detracts from the loveliness of the objects. It just shows a deepened appreciation, a better understanding, and an effort to understand even more. Because now we have planets beyond our own solar system being discovered. There are nearly 200 of those that have been found in the past 10 years. So we're studying the planets nearby just to know more about them,
mm-hmm.
but also to appreciate the solar systems of other stars.
Yeah. It seems that there's a lot of, you know, you mentioned the stuff of the Kuiper Belt. There's so much there at the edge that is being investigated. And one of the things that you write about in terms of the Kuiper Belt is that those objects out there seem all to be exiles.
Yeah, I think of them that way, especially because some of them have been thrown out there by gravitational interactions with the giant planets. And the fact that Pluto is being talked about as being a candidate for exile, really, from the planetary roll call. In fact, at the Hayden Planetarium in New York, which is now the Rose Center for Earth and Space, when you look at the exhibit there on the main floor, there's a list of planets, and Pluto isn't on there. Pluto has already been moved into the Kuiper Belt. So it's a very interesting time that we're living through.
Yeah. Well, the Kuiper Belt is very, very interesting. Could it tell us about the formation of our solar system and where
Certainly
we came
people
from?
People think that conditions out there have probably changed a lot less than certainly conditions on Earth. I mean, we change the planet, but it is also active on its own. It is still losing the heat of its original formation, and we experience that in earthquakes and tsunamis. But way out at the edge of the solar system, where things are extremely cold, probably less change has taken place in these bodies over the history of the solar system. So there's great interest in sending a robot probe out there to investigate. And finally, one is ready to go. This is a spacecraft mission to Pluto that will be launched in January.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is science writer and author Dava Sobel. Her latest book is The Planets. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. How many planets did the ancients recognize?
They recognized seven: the Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Of course, they thought the Earth was the center of the universe. They didn't think of it as a planet. And the reason we have a seven-day week is encoded in that recognition. And the names of the days of the week are all planet names. Sunday and Monday are obvious, but because the names, some of the names of our English days of the week borrow the names of the gods from the Norse languages, they don't sound familiar. So Friday in English for Frigga, which compares to the Venerdì in Italian of Venus, where the name is more, all the Romance languages, you can see Venus in the name of Friday. And Tuesday, which sounds a lot more like Mars in the Romance languages, and Wednesday for Mercury, and on like that.
So other civilizations, they have joined names together. They've taken something like, for instance, Mercury, so appropriately named, and connected a god with the planet.
Yes, well, I think humans are always trying to figure out the natural world. So when you see bright objects moving in the sky, they can easily be thought of as divinities. So all of these bodies had a divine significance. And Mercury especially really behaves the way the god Mercury behaved, in the sense that he was the messenger of the gods because he was very rapid. And the motion of the planet Mercury is the most rapid. So that makes sense. And because we always see Mercury in twilight time, because it's so close to the sun that you never see it in the sky in the middle of the night. You catch it just before sunrise or just after sunset. That really meshes well with the idea of Mercury as the go-between between the worlds of the living and the dead. And he was the one who conducted the souls of the dead down to Hades. So the others, though, are more open to question. I mean, why was Jupiter considered the king of the gods? I mean, we know now that it's the largest of the planets, but that wasn't known then. And Venus is the one that really looks the brightest, so you might think it was the largest, but it was associated with beauty and femininity. And it's interesting now that radar probes sent to Venus have been able to map the surface of the planet, even though it's completely hidden from view by dense acidic clouds. But by radar, the surface has now been mapped, and so all the features had to be named. This was an enormous nomenclature problem for the astronomers. And the International Astronomical Union came up with an all-female naming scheme so that the various features have names for goddesses of the hunt or goddesses of love or famous women in history. I'm happy to say there is a crater on Venus named for Galileo's daughter, Maria Celeste. And some of the smallest features are just called by girls' first names.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. You were talking about meteorites from the moon and meteorites from various places. How do we know where they came from?
That is an excellent question. Well, might you ask? It's because their composition is so different from Earth rocks. That's another place where scientific knowledge has progressed so far that it's now possible to see a rock in the Antarctic, for example, where most of the Martian meteorites are discovered. They look different from Earth rocks. Scientists who are trained can actually get intrigued by a rock just because it looks like it doesn't belong. And then it can be analyzed in the laboratory.
Oh, do they use the spectrograph? Is that...
They use that. They actually have pieces. They have the rock right there to analyze, and then they can compare its composition with the constitution of the various planets.
Oh, wonderful. Probes. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the question.
It was a Viking probe, two of them, that landed on Mars in 1976. It actually had little laboratories on board, and they dug up, they just scooped up material from the surface and analyzed it. And so when rocks turn up here that look alien, their composition can be compared to the now known composition of Mars, and it matches element for element.
Hmm. What have we learned from the rocks that were collected from the moon?
Oh, many, many wonderful things. One of the most interesting to me is how dry the moon is. We use expressions such as dry as dust or dry as bones, bone dry. But bones are really very wet compared to anything on the moon. And Earth dust is wet. The moon has no water. And so the composition there is quite different. And the moon is limited in the kinds of rocks it contains. The Earth is much more varied in gems and minerals. And we have numerous gems that are associated with the moon. Oh, moonstones, pearls, things that look the way the moon looks. But none of those substances could be formed on the moon because of its complete lack of water.
Hmm. Now, the composition of our moon, our other moons in the solar system, are they similar or different?
They're pretty different. Our moon, according to the most popularly held theory now, our moon actually formed early in the history of the solar system when violence predominated and objects were colliding with one another. And something about half the size of the Earth struck the Earth, and the force of that collision sent a lot of material into near-Earth space, and the material made a ring around the Earth, like the ring around Saturn. And over time, all of that material coalesced into the moon. But anything that was capable of evaporating did. And so the moon has an affinity with the Earth. There are a lot of similar elements, but there's no water.
Hmm. But without the moon, we would have no water, right?
Well, the moon has helped keep the Earth on a pretty even keel. The water on Earth was probably delivered here by comets that crashed to Earth, and their ice melted in the crash and delivered our oceans of water. But what the moon does is raise tides in our oceans. It's almost as though the moon is jealous of the abundance of water here on Earth and keeps trying to pull on it. So we experience tides twice a day.
Hmm. Recently, I understand that there's new information coming to us about the moon thanks to the Hubble telescope.
And yes, well, the Hubble has been a great ally in exploring the planets.
And it could be that what is on the moon could provide a source of oxygen for humans going to the moon.
Yes, yes. This is a hope that the Moon-Mars Initiative people have, that will actually be possible to mine oxygen on the moon.
What an idea.
The moon has no atmosphere. All previous lunar astronauts have had to carry their atmosphere from home. And the first two discovered, after they'd been tromping around on the lunar surface, when they climbed back into their capsule, they had the smell of something burning. It smelled like wet ashes in a fireplace, was how they described it. And it really was the moon dust burning in the oxygen.
Hmm. So much out there to explore. It brings back into focus the ancient Greeks and the ancients and how they began to describe the solar system and how they began to puzzle out how it was put together and how it works.
And we're still doing that.
Yeah, precisely.
And it's been done through science fiction, too, in many interesting ways. I was never much of a science fiction buff in my teen years or even my adult years, but because of the need to approach Mars as a science fiction planet, I really did read quite a bit of science fiction and just had the best time reading The War of the Worlds and The Martian Chronicles and sharing that view of the planets. Because people really know the planets through these venues. And it's important to, and fun, to look at them that way.
Is there a planet that you feel a special affinity for?
Well, that would have to be the Earth. It's really the only one that would have me. So I return the favor. But I have trouble picking a favorite one. It's almost like asking me which of my children I love best. But when I have the chance to look through a backyard telescope, Saturn is really the one that's the biggest thrill to look at. I think the view of Saturn through a telescope, which, you know, it doesn't matter that you know it has rings. When you see it the first time, it is completely astounding. You get the feeling that someone has pasted a little picture at the end of the tube just to fool you. And it's so exquisite. And I go to a lot of public observing nights. I actually have a telescope, but I'm so terrible with equipment that I hardly ever use it. But fortunately, astronomers are among the most generous of hobbyists, and they love nothing better than to have people who've never looked through a telescope before come and have a look. And so you can go, almost every town has an amateur astronomy group, and they always have at least one night a year. Some of them have at least one night a month when they will be taking their equipment out somewhere and making it available to anyone who's interested. And if you go and look, they are only too happy to explain to you what you're seeing and why. And a lot of them will admit that it was the sight of Saturn that got them hooked.
Hmm. So if you were able to climb on board a spaceship and travel out to a planet, would it be Saturn?
No.
No.
I wouldn't go to Saturn because I really don't think I could survive that trip. And not just because of my age, but just the atmosphere is hostile. You were asking before, though, and I forgot to answer your question about the moons of other planets. Probably, if I could get all the way to Saturn, I might be able to visit Titan, the largest of Saturn's moons. But the real possible destination for us would be our own moon or the planet Mars. Because Mars does have a thin atmosphere. It's not really breathable for us. But science fiction writers and real scientists have a view of how to transform the atmosphere of Mars so that the planet would be habitable for a human presence.
Mm.
So that would be my pick. There are also some moons of Jupiter that are as big as planets, but not really hospitable to visitors.
Yeah. I guess when I asked the question, it was sort of a really big make-believe kind of question.
So yeah. I'll take it that way. And which would be the planet I would just love to see up close? And that would be Jupiter. Saturn or Jupiter, I just think they are the most glamorous. But here, happy as I am to be on the Earth's surface and just looking at the sky without a telescope, the prettiest one to see is Venus because it is so bright and just looks so pretty, especially when it's near the moon and they make a nice a nice duo together. It's just pleasing to all the senses to look at that.
Yeah.
Especially the aesthetic sense.
Yeah. Did you ever consider a career in astronomy?
Well, I feel I have one. I'm not a real astronomer, but I certainly have a career studying the subject, enjoying the subject, and writing about it for people who have not enjoyed it as much as they might because they felt intimidated by it.
Hmm.
I don't think I could be a real astronomer. I think it's too late for me, and I'm not good enough at math.
Hmm. Another one of the delights of your book, The Planets, was meeting astronomers, whether they're professional or amateur. And maybe you would talk with the astronomers that you feature in the chapter Night Air before we have to wrap up.
Yes, the heroine of that chapter is Caroline Herschel, who was the sister of William Herschel, who discovered the planet Uranus. And that was the first one to be discovered. And she really was, they had both started as musicians and then got interested in astronomy and became the premier astronomers of their time. Even today, it's possible for an amateur astronomer to make important contributions to the science. It's one of the few fields in science where that continues to be true. And I had fun in the chapter thinking of Caroline Herschel, who not only witnessed the discovery of Uranus, but lived to see the discovery of Neptune about 60 years later. Even longer, almost 80 years later. No, I'll stick with 60. I'll stick with 60. And I'm just thinking of her age at the time of each discovery and how she might have been in contact with the young American Mariah Mitchell, the only other woman in the world at that time who had discovered a comet. And so I imagined that chapter as a long letter from the elderly Caroline Herschel to the young Mariah Mitchell, congratulating her on her discovery, but then reminiscing through her own comet discoveries and the work of her brother and the work that it later inspired that led to the discovery of Neptune.
Hmm. There, we're going to have to leave it. We're out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon, Deva.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Deva Sobel, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, The Planets. The book is published by Viking. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Todd Gleason in on a Monday.
Me. Okay.
Well, I tried to wave at you there in the studio, but didn't get that opportunity up front. Hey,
okay.
We did not too bad, terribly bad on the ag side with fundraising over the last week or so. We'd like to thank all of the folks that called in support of agricultural programming. We sure do appreciate that. If you managed to do that, that would be great. And if you didn't, you probably still can at WILLpledge.org if you really want to. Hey, let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade now with the numbers from the board and the wheat pit. December futures are off. December contract down 6 3/4 today. Had a high of 329.5 in the wheat pit. The low at 322.5. Settlement price there 323.25. They were down 6 3/4. March futures at 343 high. Low at 337. Settled at 338.5. They were down 6.5 cents. May futures in the wheat pit 349.5. The high. The low at 46. Settlement price at 346.75. And they finished day 5.25 lower. July futures at 357. 7.5 high and low at 352.25, settled at 353.25, down 5.5 cents in September futures in the wheat pit. 360.25 the high, the low at 359, settled at $3.16. They were off 4.75. From the corn pit, futures managed to trade in the December contract through $2 today, but it held pretty well. Did finish at 199.5. It was down 2 cents for that December contract. Had a high of 201.5. The low was at $1.99. Settlement price there at $1.99.5 down 2. March futures at 214.25 high, low at 212.25. Settlement price for the March corn, $2.12.25, and they were down a penny and 3/4 for the day. May contract in the corn pit, 222.25 the high, the low at 220.75. Settlement price there at $2.21.25, down a penny and a half. And July futures were off 1.5 as well. They had a high today of $2.29.5, a low at 228. Settlement price at $2.28.25. September futures, 236.75 the high, the low at 235.75. And settlement price at $2.36. And they were down a penny and a quarter. Next year's December futures in the corn pit, 246.5 the high, the low at 245.5. And the red December settled at $2.46. They were down 0.75 cents today. December oats now 169, the high, the low at 166.25. Settlement price at 168.5, up 2.75. And the March futures were up 2.75. 175.75 the high, the low at $1.73.5. The settlement price at $1.75.75 on the March oats. That was on the high for the day. Up 2.75 on the day. Soy complex now, November beans, 575.5, the high, the low at 566.5, settlement price at 575, trading through some upside resistance and managed a 2.75 gain today. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois, about all the things that have been happening at the Chicago Board of and the Mercantile Exchange during the closing market report this afternoon. That at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. By the way, we'll get a quick review and update on the happenings in Louisville this week. It is National FFA Week Convention in Louisville, and we'll update you on how that convention is going to proceed in Louisville this week. This is the last year for the convention in Louisville. Probably those of you who were in FFA will remember that it was in Kansas City for years and years, moved to Louisville a few years ago, and next year, beginning next year, it will move to the national headquarters of the National FFA, and that will be in Indianapolis. But this year, Louisville. We'll try to keep you updated on what's happening there. And FFA, for all the high schoolers that are getting ready to go down to that great city, good luck on your trip and enjoy yourselves. Now, January soybeans, 588 the high, the low at 578, settlement price at 587.5, up 3 for the day. March futures at 596.75 high, low at 586. Settlement price at 596.25. They were up 4.25. And the May futures, 602.5 the high, low at 591. Settlement price at 602. They were up 4.75. And the July futures at 607.5 high, low at 596.5 in the bean pit, low at six. Settlement price at 607.25. They were up 5.5 in the August futures. 606 the high, the low at 598.5. Settlement price at $6.05. They were up 4. And next year's November contract, a 612 high, low at 602. And November 2006 soybeans settled at $6.11. They were up a nickel for the day. December bean meal, 171.20. The high, the low at 168.50. Settlement price at $169.90. They were up 50 cents. January meal up 20 cents at 171.20. They had a high of 172.80 and a low at 170.40. December bean oil, 23.78. The high, the low at 23.05. Settlement price, 23.76. They were up 28. And the January futures, 24.02. The high, the low at 23.30. Settlement price at 24.01. And they finished 31 higher for the day. Just sitting here thinking about the FFA convention and the good times that most of the farm audience probably had. A lot of the young men and women have made that trip either to Kansas City and Louisville, and I suppose they're beaming at this point. That's a gathering, depending on the year, but this year of about 50,000 high school age students will make it to Louisville. It's a huge gathering and a great big event for agriculture across the nation. And once again, good luck to all those in the Illinois and Indiana, Wisconsin, Missouri, Minnesota, Iowa listening area, and other parts of the national and international region that might be listening on the website if you're on your way to that area. Good luck. And now we'll turn it over to Celeste Quinn and take a look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, Todd. It looks like it was a mixed day today on the Merc. Feeder cattle were lower, live cattle mixed. December lean hogs finished up. Well, hogs, as a general, the contracts that we cover, December, February, April, and May, mixed with just with one contract down that April. Lean hogs, February bellies finish lower on the day today. October feeder cattle, the high today 115.90, the low 115.50, the settlement 115.85, that down 10. November 114.25, the high 113.85, the low, the settlement 113.90, that down 52.5. January 112.10, the high, the low 111.40, the settlement 111.90, that down 22.5. October live cattle 88.55, the high, the low today 87.90, the settlement 88.37.5, that down 20. December live cattle 90.15, the high 89.45, the low 90 even, the settlement that up 7.5. December lean hog 61.15, the high 60.10, the low, the settlement today for December lean hogs 60.95, that up 17.5. February 64.45, the high 63.40, the low 64.27.5, the settlement that up 12.5. April 65.37.5, the high 64.30, the low, the settlement 64.95, that down 7.5. May lean hogs today's high 65.60, the low 64.90, the settlement 65.60, that up 25. And February pork bellies 88.30, the high 86.05, the low 87.75, the settlement, that down 45. The Dow is up 114 points at 10,329. The S&P 500 14 higher at 1193, and the NASDAQ up 18 points at 2100.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson and Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
We're getting old. The Beatles album Rubber Soul came out 40 years ago. I'm looking through you. Now, a collection of contemporary rockers have a tribute to the Fab Four.
Maybe you can go in a different direction with it. I mean, you're never going to be the Beatles.
Resold Rubber Soul, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
It's coming up on 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in southern and eastern Indiana, cloudy with scattered areas of light rain and occasional drizzle. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with scattered areas of drizzle, mainly south of Lake Michigan. Highs ranging from 45 in eastern Indiana.